Hello and welcome to another episode of Must See Matches. This is episode number 31, which will hopefully be a lot more cheerful than episode 30. I am, as always, Kieran LeFord, and joining me is the man behind Must See Matches, of course, as every week. It's Mark Buckledy. Mark, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Can't complain. I've done that already.
Yeah, we did that while we weren't recording. This week, we are taking our second trip to the Impact Zone.
Yep, it is.
In Orlando, Florida. It's December the 5th, 2004. It is TNA Turning Point, and it is the losing team must disband cage match between America's Most Wanted, who are Cowboy James Storm and Wildcat Chris Harris, against Triple X, who are the Fallen Angel Christopher Daniels and Primetime Elix Skipper. And joining us is the man we said last week probably knows, he's probably only second to Jeff Jarrett in his TNA knowledge. It's Garrett Kidney. Garrett, how are you doing?
Listen, I don't want to immediately come on here and make any bold claims, but I've listened to enough of Jeff Jarrett's podcast to know that I think I know more about TNA history at this stage than he does.
I do forget about the points where he wasn't there, and I also forget about the points where he was a wrestler and got bashed in the head a lot. I also forget he's a wrestler and is probably prone to lying quite a lot. So, yeah, no, fair enough. We'll upgrade you to the man who knows the most about TNA.
Get out of here, Double J. It is fun to listen to those podcasts because, like, Mick Foley, I think, is like the high tier of is both introspective and remembers things, which ideally is what you want for one of these things. Bischoff is like the perfect combination of is completely the opposite of introspective, like wildly arrogant, and also doesn't remember anything. I'm just throwing out, like, immediately you invite me on, it's like, Bischoff fraud, Jarrett doesn't remember anything. Hey, how are we doing?
I would go with both of those, I think. And I'm also shocked that Mick Foley remembers anything.
I know, of all the people who should forget everything, it's the man who's been hitting the head more than probably most human beings. And yes, there's him, like, remembering the intricacies. It probably helps that he wrote, like, 17 books.
Yes.
So he has it all written down somewhere.
But. To that end, not the end of being hit in the head, like the end of knowing a lot about TNA, like, how did you end up becoming a TNA guy? So how did it become your promotion?
Yeah, that's a curse. So I would have watched bits and pieces of it on the old wrestling channel. Mm-hmm. And I would have seen like the just the most dreadful diabolical nonsense. Like anytime I turn it on, it would be like the Dup Cup or like the Hard 10, which are fun for what they are, but they're never what you want to be exposed to first in any wrestling company. And you're sitting there, it's like, so there's this point scoring system where if you attack JB, you get 5 points. No, I don't want to watch this. But it was in 2006, my brother brought me back. He went to Boston on holiday, and he brought me back as a present from that holiday, a copy of the Best of the X Division Volume 2, which was a DVD stuffed full of Samoa Joe and AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels and Chris Sabin and Alex Shelley and Sharkboy and PD Williams and Jay Lethal matches. Mm. And it was at that moment I was like, oh, there's good wrestlers in the world, because I would have been like super disaffected by WWE at that stage.
Yeah.
Because like, I would have grown up a WWE guy. I wasn't a WCW guy. So I would have been a long-term WWE guy. And it was like 05, 06. I was like, you reach the stage where I would have been 13, 14 at that stage, where I reached the stage where every teenager goes in one of two directions, where it's like, I'm going to make this my life, or I'm going to do the same thing and abandon this weird side hobby of my childhood. And I was like, TNA wrestling, this thing with Styles and Shelley and Sharkboy, of course, Sharkboy and Sabin and Petey. These guys, these are my guys. And then I would have watched on Bravo, I think it was on in 06. Yeah, I would have been Bravo at that stage. On Bravo, I would have watched the 2-hour primetime special that had the Christian and Rhino barbed wire cage match, and also had Kurt Angle's in-ring debut against Abyss. And that was the first like episode of Impact I watched that was my full-time watching Impact. And I'm like, I'm done with this WWE nonsense. I'm on board with this TNA stuff. And it was a very abusive relationship over the years. But listen, it's turned out okay, I guess. I can't complain.
More highs than lows. I mean, like, even the bad stuff you get entertainment out of.
Yeah, for the most part, especially in TNA, where, like, to be fair to Vince Russo, which is not a statement people say very often, but when the man writes television by himself, it's insane.
It's never not boring. No, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
It's never like 2020 WWE where you just sit there and you're like, why does this exist? Who is this for? At least when you watch his nonsense, you get like the 2007 Christmas special, which I think is like peak his nonsense.
Is that barbed wire Christmas tree?
It's barbed wire Christmas tree.
Oh, fantastic.
And there's just so much nonsense on that episode. It's like the dude just starts writing a sitcom in the middle of wrestling television shows. And you know, it's like fair play to him. He can never get a job in real TV, but he can turn wrestling into fake TV every so often.
Mm. I think we covered this on the Abyss and AJ Styles episode, Mark, but what's your relationship with TNA?
I've said multiple times that WCW, weirdly enough, came first before WWF for me. Mm. And I started watching wrestling when I was about 15, 16. So older than most people, really. And because of the time as well, it was the early 2000s. I actually started like going online and finding like message board spoilers and all that kind of stuff within a year or two of watching wrestling. So WCW went down, but I still kept going on like the same news sites. And then I heard about this thing called TNA that was possibly starting up. So literally I was aware of TNA before it even got its pay-per-views. So, and I had fond memories of AJ Styles from his time in WCW at the back end. Air Raid with AJ Styles in a pilot's jumpsuit, if you've not seen that. And quite a few of the early TNA guys were the WCW guys that either didn't want to go to WWE or WWE didn't want to have their hands on. So I kind of have these fond memories. It was like, I watched WCW Worldwide where Chris Harris and Shark Boy were the jobber talents. So it's kind of, I saw them turn up. It's like, oh, I recognize those guys.
Mm. You're watching your favorite jobbers do good somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, young me marked out like crazy the first couple of times he saw the Catatonic.
So this match in particular, let's try and catch up and contextualize a bit. So according to the Wrestling Observer newsletter, the company is in dire straits at this point, which in 2022, I think it has been for approximately 21 years. That's kind of like standard operating procedure for TNA / Impact Wrestling, as far as I can figure out. This show, Turning Point, is Dusty Rhodes' first pay-per-view as head booker, I think, although he's just sort of finishing off Jeff Jarrett and Dutch Mantel booking.
He took over about 2 weeks earlier in the middle of like the pay-per-view cycle.
Yeah. So this is like, it's always a wild period for TNA, but this is a wild period for TNA because in June, they launch Impact as like a squash match show to build up that week's pay-per-view. So they're still doing weekly pay-per-views and they have a weekly TV show. Weekly pay-per-view ends on September the 8th, which is the Jeff Jarrett, Jeff Hardy match. The date with fate, is that right?
The date with fate on September 8th.
That's the one. Always,
it rhymes. That's how you remember it.
I know. And after that, Impact then becomes more of a regular higher profile show. So you'll get matches between stars as well as the squashes. And they switch to monthly pay-per-view starting on November the 7th. So this is only TNA's second monthly pay-per-view. I was trying to work out, when did they introduce the six-sided ring? Because
that was on the first Impact. On the June 4th Impact is when the six-sided ring started. And originally it was just going to be an Impact thing, but then everyone thought it looked cool, so they brought it to the Asylum show too.
So they've done so much stuff just in the past few months. It's a constant new era of TNA is beginning, as far as I can figure out.
Yeah, because you get the end of the Asylum year, the start of Impact, then the like the six-sided ring introduced. So the change of booking from Jarrett, which even like Jarrett Mantel was a relative, it was only a year old as a booking committee. Mm. They were together since like October the year before. We're over to Dusty now, obviously into the monthly pay-per-view era. And as you mentioned, like there's two periods where TNA came closest to not, actually three, I guess. Three periods where TNA came closest to not existing anymore. Mm. There's August 2002, where they quickly ran out of money and then Panda bought the company. Then there's like, this is like the early stage of like the 04, 05 run where they came right up to the brink, where by the time you get to the middle of 05, the company is really teetering on the edge. Mm. And if they
Jarrett out the back, like slashing costs like crazy as well, haven't you?
Yes, slashing costs and using the knife that he used to slash the costs to stab in his own son's back every so often.
Jeff is the problem.
By the time you get to like June, July, if they don't get that Spike TV deal, the company's done. Like full stop. But they do get the Spike deal and they survive. And then the third one is all the way into 2016 when there's that big showdown with Anthem and Billy and the Harris Bros company, which name escapes me. Arrowlux, there you Arrowlux, go.
Yeah, which always and sounds like a roofing company to me, or double glazing or something.
And the big showdown then. So like this is right in the period where like these monthly pay-per-views need to work. Or else this company will go under. Like the characters are sick of running like money into the ground for this fruitless wrestling product that does not look like it's going to make money at any stage. Because in case people don't know, you might think, oh, but they're on television. They're paying to be on television.
Yes.
Fox Sports aren't paying them. They're paying Fox Sports to be on TV. So every TV show that they air is more money in the hole. So these pay-per-views need to succeed.
That's just a crazy business model. I've no idea how they made it work.
And it's also crazy that the three, so this is the second of three TNA matches that we're going to be covering on our podcast. And all of them are in this 2004 to 2005 sweet spot.
Oh, so we've only got one more left.
We've only got one more left.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's in the top 10, I believe. I think most people can guess if one TNA match was called Must See, I think almost everyone would choose the same match. So you know what it is TNA.
Of course. Abyss versus Lance Hoyt from Sacrifice 2005.
Okay. This is a trivia test for you, Garrett. Two matches from the Tennessee Fairgrounds era got nominated out of only 17 total TNA matches. Do you want to take a guess at a Tennessee Fairgrounds sort of a weekly pay-per-view match that someone would call must-see?
Well, one of them has to be Triple X AMW. If it's not, whoever nominated those Nashville matches is wrong. Because like the best match of the Asylum days is the first Triple X AMW cage match.
Where they only had four sites.
Yeah. It's only one four of sites them, of steel.
One of them is an AJ Styles versus Jerry Lynn match, which I assume is the first one.
There's I'm like not, 17 of them.
Yeah, that's why I assume
they,
that.
Yeah, they wrestled a lot on those pay-per-views.
The other one is one that, as someone that listens to your podcast, I know that you guys enjoyed at the time. Perry Saturn versus Mike Barton.
Listen, I would not go like in no world would I say it's must see. It's like if you were to rank the matches in wrestling, not even TNA history, whereas it's like Mike Barton versus Perry Saturn. But that match, it fucking rocks. That match rules.
Mike Barton / Bart Gunn has had one must see match in his life, and it's where a fat man punched him in the face at WrestleMania and knocked him out.
No, you should watch that Perry Saturn match because they just start shooting on each other and bleed a bunch. It actually rules. And like the finish is Mike Barton punches Perry Saturn in the head so hard he breaks his own hand, and then Perry Saturn immediately puts a submission on and taps him out. It absolutely rocks.
Incredible. So you mentioned a previous AMW versus Triple X cage match. I only was able to watch sort of like the month of TV building up to this, but can you sort of like contextualize the America's Most Wanted versus Triple X history and feud in any way?
So of course we have to start with sex, as we always do in the history of TNA.
Of course.
So America's Most Wanted were the white meat babyface tag team, face of TNA, the like very wholesome baby faces. And then you get Triple X, the team of Low-Ki as well, who was out of TNA at this point. But in that original feud, it was Low-Ki, Elix Skipper, and Christopher Daniels formed Triple X as part of the Sports Entertainment Extreme Unit, or SEX. Love the Asylum year of TNA. Yeah. And that was the defining feud, because AMW had come off the back of a feud with the Disciples of the New Church. Great matches in their own right with Slash and Brian Lee. Really good stuff. And then went straight into a feud with Triple X. And that was the feud for basically all of 03, where the whole thing was Triple X would keep beating AMW because they would have the man advantage. They have three men. Triple X have two men. Also, they have like 17 other people in sex. So you'd get like, I don't know, David Flair running in every so often.
Christ.
So the whole story building up to that first cage match, which was in June of 03, was outside interference, naturally. You do a cage match to negate the outside interference. That's where AMW finally beat Triple X for the first time with a death sentence off a steel cage. Yes, that is Chris Harris doing a leg drop from the top of a cage. Very ill-advised on your spine, but freaking awesome visual. Yes. And that match, as I said, far and away the best match of the Asylum here. Like, easily. If you're going to nominate a must-see match, the problem is it lives in the shadow of their even better cage match that we're going to talk about. But they left that feud kind of sit for about a year. Like Skipper was out of TNA here and there because he did all Japan dates. Daniels was out of TNA here and there because he did Japan dates as well. But they came back together in like the summer of 04 as like a kind of weird babyface team. And they renewed the rivalry with Triple X then. They also, did you watch as far as like the split tag team title thing they did?
No, I know there was some sort of like almost Lucha Perez Increíble stuff going on with like the team, I believe your podcast christened Stormy Daniels.
Stormy Daniels?
James Storm and Christopher Daniels.
yes, indeed. So they did the like split thing where like Harris and... Daniels and Storm were taken out. So Harris and Skipper were put together in a tag title match and then they won. And then they lost the tag titles to Daniels and Storm. So you had like the mixed match tag team champions and then they eventually lost it. And that's like the build into this feud. Mm. And then Triple X turned heel heading into the Victory Road match. And then Triple X were the heel tag team against, you know, the classic, the defining babyface tag team in frankly TNA history, not just the Asylum here, America's World Wanted.
So at the first, Victory Road is the first of the monthly pay-per-views, and these two teams have an elimination last team standing match that can charitably be called a disaster because Elix Skipper gets concussed before Daniels is eliminated but doesn't tell anybody till afterwards.
Yeah, so he's concussed into like the first 90 seconds of the match.
Jesus.
And When you watch that match, knowing that, you can see it, like the man's out on his feet. Mm. And ideally, he would tell somebody because it's an elimination match. And I know for a fact, like Daniels is at that stage a real veteran already.
Oh, yeah.
Like Daniels has been around since the early 90s. If he knew Skipper was concussed, they'd call an audible and they'd get Skipper out of there and he'd do the rest of the match.
He'd eliminate him himself.
So, like, very clearly, they went through the match as planned. Mm. Only after Daniels was eliminated, it went down to Skipper and Harris as the final two. You could see on the floor, that's when Skipper tells Harris, like, things aren't going so well for me here. And then they have a very clumsy, bad exchange toward the end because the man is concussed. Mm. I would not expect anyone to wrestle well while concussed. And the match is like an utter disaster. And it's like a fun Chris Harris, James Storm thing. That they have matches that are utter disasters before they have defining matches in TNA history. Because if you look at the like the Sacrifice 2007 match, their Texas Death match, like the super bloody insane match they have before that lockdown, the month before, they have the disastrous blindfold steel cage match.
Yeah,
it's one of the most unintentionally funny matches I've ever seen. I get great enjoyment out of that match. I'm shocked it isn't on this list, to be honest. I would happily watch that again.
So clearly the key to motivating Chris Harris and James Storm is to have them have an absolutely terrible match that they feel they have to make up for.
Yeah. So I started watching the TV with the 12th of November Impact. They recap the end of the last team standing match with Daniels destroying AMW with chairs. They don't tell you when this happened. This little video also doubles as an announcement that the two teams will have a cage match and triples as a plug for Turning Point. It's shown twice on the show and nobody from either team actually appears on this television show.
Yeah, they had Dusty announce the match on the pay-per-view, to be fair. So like literally straight after the match, they had Dusty come out. He's accepting his director of authority role, which he won in an election from Vince Russo, fair and square, I assume. Mm. And one of his first decisions is that it will be a rematch. A turning point between AMW Triple X inside Six Sides of Steel.
Yes.
Can we just say the words Six Sides of Steel are like the best sounding words in wrestling history. The sibilance, is that the
yes. Yeah.
The combination of S sounds, Six Sides of Steel. It's wonderful on the mic.
for their many faults, TNA on occasion do hit on some cracking marketing slogans such as the date with fate on September 8th. Like there's somebody is earning their bonuses in the marketing department.
Yeah, and when you watch the opening of these impacts, you get the Barry Scott, this is TNA, the new face of professional wrestling. And you're like, oh, that's wrestling.
It's something else I wanted to kind of talk about that you have mentioned on your show is the injection of David Sahadi into this show and TNA as a whole. For people who don't know, he was like a producer and director for WWE and TNA, and he introduced a lot of high production value stuff. So they used them a lot in WWE. They had all these very slick like promo shots of guys basically standing in a crumbling coliseum that they used in video packages for years, and they're all shot on 35 millimeter movie film. And he brought that idea of doing that kind of stuff, spending that money to WWE, and then he brought that idea to TNA as well. And the production value shoots up when he arrives. He's responsible for one of my favorite shots in wrestling, which is Sting standing in the pissing rain in a car park, essentially. And all they've done to make it an incredible shot, well, they did two things. They shot it on 35 millimeter film, so it looks amazing. And then they ran it backwards, so the rain goes up and he looks incredible in it. Without David Sahadi, I wouldn't have a career, because I basically copied the Desire promos for the wrestling work I was doing at the time. And that's what got me a job. And that's what gave me a career doing video work for the past 18 years. So cheers, Dave.
I think he's legit like one of the, I think, unheralded geniuses in wrestling history. Because like no one talks about Dave Sahadi. Like we're in Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame season. That man should be on that ballot. Like it's always hard to quantify non-wrestlers, but the man is a visionary, like a legit visionary in pro wrestling. And he deserves that credit. All of like what you aesthetically think of as TNA was basically his creation. Because if you look at TNA before he came in and TNA after, all of the Barry Scott stuff, all of the This Is TNA, all of the opening packages that you got during that era, that was him. And he completely overhauled like the aesthetic of this brand.
It goes a bit far at sometimes. Like once you get to the nexus of humanity, that's kind of taking the piss a bit, and they've kind of run out of ideas. But like there is a certain level of epic that goes along with the like the work he brought, I think, to WWE and TNA. So continuing on this build after that sidebar about producing wrestling television, I did also take some notes about some other stuff that amused me or caught my eye on these impacts. Kid Cash, Michael Shane and Frankie Kazarian versus Psicosis, Hector Garza and LA Park. And I just wrote "what" in all caps because I couldn't believe this match was happening. There was no chemistry, thought or planning to anything that happened. Don West is banging on about how brilliant Hector Garza is as he loses his grip on Cash and almost drops him. And then Cash bops Garza with a coconut and pins him in under 2 minutes. I don't think either of either LA Park or Psicosis tagged in this match. There's an amazing Monty Brown hype video, which is like clips of interviews and clips of him pouncing people. He should have been a massive star.
Oh yeah, absolute whiff. I was such a massive fan of Monty Brown around 2004, 2005. It's like how that didn't work and how his WWE run didn't work, I don't know.
Count Marquis Von Kor, yeah. And Alex Shelley versus Chris Sabin, which I wasn't expecting. And for 2 minutes and 13 seconds, they wrestle like they're from the future compared to the other crap on this show, which was great. Impact on the 19th, the first 10 minutes is constant shouting, and I couldn't understand what was going on for most of it. But unfortunately, the outsiders have arrived. Shane Douglas, I enjoy Shane Douglas as an interviewer. I think he's hilarious just because he's doing full franchise persona, but he's holding a microphone and interviewing people in front of a camera. It's so ridiculous. It is exactly how the franchise would be a journalist.
And as a firm Scott Hudson stan, I cannot stand for this franchise love because he replaced Scott Hudson.
Oh no, really? I will. Okay, Scott Hudson is better, but I did get like quite a lot of entertainment out of Shane Douglas in his bright yellow t-shirt.
He's always wearing the yellow shirt. He's like, "You franchise, I'm here backstage interviewing people with my franchise voice."
Exactly. Yeah.
And Garrett, I mean, you guys, you and Liam, are essentially the biggest stands for Goldilocks I think have ever existed. And I'm pretty sure it's a bit, but I'm also sure I don't know if it is.
In defense of Goldilocks, who people hated at the time. If you really read like the PW Torch newsletter, every time she's on screen, there's either a note from backstage about from wrestlers. It's like, why on earth does Goldilocks have a job? She's terrible. Why is she even here? Everybody hates her. And then all of the show reviews are like, she's hammy and overacting. And then when you watch it, it's like, she's meant to be hammy and overacting. And she's doing like this 70s actress thing where she's like, darling, I'm rich and I'm going to buy all the wrestlers. And it's actually very good. In fairness to Goldilocks, 2022 Impact star as well. She showed up at Slammiversary. So the legacy of Goldilocks lives on long past these 2004 shows.
Well, in November 2004, it's Shane Douglas doing the interviews, as we said, and he interviews Triple X through a cage wall in the car park. And Skipper invites AMW to come and fight out there tonight. AMW actually show up and have a match against Johnny Swinger, and Jesus fucking Christ, Glenn Gilberti Disco Inferno is on my screen. Tanay is trying to commentate while Nash and Hall are making jokes and Jarrett keeps interrupting him. Harris presses Trinity over the top rope onto Swinger and Gilberti. They all brawl out of the building after bumping into Hall and Nash and Jarrett. Jarrett and Hall throw AMW into the cage where Triple X beat them up as we cut away to a second limo, because the first one arrived earlier in the show, arriving. Hall, Nash and Double J go into the production truck and the beatdown is barely even in the back of the shot as the focus is on the real stars. We're 17 minutes into this show and we don't see any of the participants in the match we're going to talk about again. But we do see Raven versus Johnny B. Bad. Yes, we get in 2004, we get Scotty Flamingo versus Johnny B. Bad on national television.
This is a very strange era of TNA where like the defining area of the Asylum Days to Fair is randomers showing up so that you get like Mike Barton versus Perry Saturn as a real match that did happen and is good. But yeah, this is like the second wave of that where you got Hall and Nash coming back. You had Jimmy Snuka on the pay-per-view. Piper's hanging around being terrible.
God, I saw an appalling Piper promo on one episode. I don't think it was any of the... I also accidentally got hold of the episode, the go-home for Victory Road, and the Piper promo on that is just, it's one of the worst pieces of television I've seen in ages. It's
that's every Roddy Piper promo in TNA. All of them, universally terrible. He's really bad in TNA. But you also had DDP showing up. You have Dustin Rhodes showing up right after Turning Point as well. So you have a bunch of people popping up here because they're trying to sell the idea that TNA is really hot at the moment.
Yeah, it's the place to be. Speaking of which, Randy Savage is here coming out to an absolutely terrible version of Pomp and Circumstance, which appears to be someone's 16-year-old nephew playing on an electric guitar for the first time with no other instrumentation. It's awful. The only other promotion for our match is Dusty in the ring pushing the cage match, and he adds the losing team splits up stip, and I also wrote he babbles about some other shit, which I imagine was the rest of the pay-per-view. We get a rematch on the 26th of November, AMW versus Gilberti and Swinger again. They're the New York connection, so NYC's heat segment on Chris Harris goes twice as long than the entire match did last week.
Jeez.
You gotta see Disco working a hold. That's what everyone wants. He keeps tweeting about how he's a good wrestler, and here you see it, grabbing his headlock.
Yeah, well, more surprising than Disco working a hold was high-flying babyface James Storm, because I think of Beer Money James Storm, who was much more of a ground attack sort of wrestler. And in this one, like he's flinging Disco around with German suplexes, he's doing top rope cross bodies, he's doing all kinds of things. And then thankfully, Harris comes in and helps him hit the death sentence, and they win. The other thing that airs on this show to hype our match is a new promo video featuring a promo from AMW, footage of the cage beatdown with Jeff Jarrett's back right in the way of the camera for every punch in the cage. 3rd of December Impact, the go-home show. Triple X get a match against Sondre Dutt and Amazing Red. Amazing Red is wearing a red do-rag over a white one on his head, so from some angles he looks like a little tiny Santa Claus flipping all over the ring.
This is December, it's close to Christmas, it makes sense.
This was 4 minutes of fast-paced fun, and the finish I thought was very clever. Red goes for the code red on Daniels, but as he pushes up to gather the torque to flip it over, Skipper hits him with a spin kick and Daniels just follows the momentum through into a pin, which I really enjoyed. Shane Douglas interviews AMW. They recap the stip and vow to be the team that stays together. And there's a hype package for the match and all of that sort of thing. And my only other note from this episode is not to do with this match at all. They have Keith Cash pin Chris Sabin in 3 minutes, 2 days before Sabin is challenging for the X title.
To be fair, there's a story at play there where Chris Sabin has the counter to the Canadian Destroyer. That's the whole build.
And he doesn't save it for the pay-per-view. He does it on two episodes of TV beforehand. And after Cash pins Sabin in 3 minutes, they immediately cut to the hype package for Sabin versus Petey Williams.
That might be bad strategy on Chris Sabin's part, to be fair. You're right. But the story is that he does have the counter to the Canadian Destroyer, and then Kid Cash beats him countering the Cradle Shock. So it's like, oh, he went in so cocky that he had the counter to Petey's move, but it turns out maybe his move can be countered too. I wouldn't have pinned him, but they had a reason for pinning him at least. It's a dumb one, but it's a reason.
Does he get pinned by someone getting fired soon? Doesn't Kid Cash get binned for continually fighting people backstage at some point soon, or do they keep him around?
He lasts like another, 5 months? I think April, May is when he's done. He is a menace these days. Like a true menace.
I have had to deal with David Cash personally. I do not ever want to have to again. So, the match itself, finally, we have reached a turning point on December the 5th. We are, of course, in the Impact Zone because they don't do shows anywhere else for another 2 years, I do believe. And it is Six Sides of Steel, losing team must split up. Triple X have some pretty funky music that I don't recall hearing before. And our commentators, of course, Don West and Mike Tanay, say a variation of this phrase 3 times before the bell rings. With Six Sides, the cage has less play, so it's harder when you hit it. They ram that home before the bell even goes.
Do you think, I'm not a physicist, but do you think that is like true to physics? That I guess because there's less surface area on each side, that means there's more tension and therefore it hurts more to hit, I think is the logic, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly the case of the ropes on the six-sided ring because each side is shorter, so the ropes are tauter.
Also, I guess unlike WWE's cage, which is like one continuous piece of mesh, each side of the cage also has steel poles supporting it. So that also adds to the firmness of the cage. So I believe Mike Tanay and Don West when they tell me this multiple times.
Also, every time they run the ropes, their backs smash into the cage because it's so close to the ropes.
Their cage makes such a great jangle noise as well. That's a very important factor in any steel cage. It's like, what's the jangly noise when somebody hits it?
And they haven't even electrified it yet.
Oh, no. Same lockdown as the blindfold match, by the way.
Oh, yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah. This match has some of my favorite and least favorite things in wrestling. One of my least favorite is anything goes, but you have to make a tag. I hate that stipulation. What's the referee for?
Counting?
Yeah, what exactly that? Like, so why does he have to enforce tags? This really got my back up about this match. And it gets my back up when it's in any match. It was in the Sting and Darby versus Lethal and Jarrett match at Full Gear. Like, yes, you can hit people with anything you like, but you've got to be the legal man to do it.
It was always a TNA thing as well. The cage matches were always like you had to be legal tags, which they were consistent, if nothing else.
Yeah. So because he's being featured on must-see matches, Chris Daniels goes for the blade a minute in, and the state of him by the end of the match, he looks like the scene in Terminator where he has to fix his own head in front of the mirror.
Also, can we say that when the bell rang, the camera was focused on the padlock to the thing, so missed the opening sort of fisticuffs?
I have things to say about the production of this
match. We both have things to say about the production of this match.
I don't know if you know this, Garrett, did TNA, even on live pay-per-views, pipe in crowd noise? Because it's on both the matches we have watched on this show so far, it sounds that way.
I don't think so for live pay-per-view. They definitely did for Impact. If you watch Impact, you know, 100% for sure.
Oh, absolutely. They absolutely do for those taped Impacts. Yeah.
But I don't think they did for pay-per-views, unless like they added like the low hum as opposed to like, you know, the more modern produced WWE crowd noise, which still sounds extraordinarily fake and somehow probably faker than this, like, yeah, the low hum. But
the crowd noise for the most part for this to me sounded like one woman yelling a lot and just a piped in drone that I'd heard on Impact. It makes the whole thing feel taped, even though it's not.
Yeah, because there is moments in this match where the crowd are going absolutely bonkers and you can hear them. So it takes a while. It's weird.
Tanay praises the crane camera looking over the top of the cage, which for the most part is pretty cool, just seconds before it misses a series of spots. The heels take over on Harris, and the referee has to send Storm back to his corner for stupid reasons. The director misses an Elix skipper spot, and then the crane camera gets drunk for a second for no reason. It just tilts on one side and some feet do something in one corner. I promise there are things I like about this match. It's just fun to dunk on, like, terrible camera work. Storm tags in. Our baby faces make a comeback. Harris hits a nice top rope cross body on Daniels after Triple X foil the death sentence, but the referee won't count because Harris isn't legal in a blood-soaked cage grudge death match.
Appreciate the commitment to rules.
Silly rules. It's old Southern wrestling rules, because I watched a whole load of old Midnight Express stuff, and they will have, they're doing no DQ against the Fantastics. And basically, what no DQ meant was you couldn't use weapons, you still had to tag, and basically, if you threw somebody over the top rope, it didn't count. That was exactly. Because it used to be over the top rope was a disqualification. And that was the only rule that it was. They were so stupid. They were so stupid. We'll get through the spot that really made me mad, and then I promise I'll stop, and we'll talk about a wrestling match. Skipper flapjacks Harris into the cage, cutting him open, and then handcuffs him to the heel corner, using handcuffs that he'd concealed under a towel. Then, in this match where tags are being enforced, the referee goes over and he looks at Chris Harris in the handcuffs and does nothing. Make up your mind. He just shouts, "Where's the key?" at Daniels. And I was like, if this is illegal, disqualify him. And then the commentary even asks, what's the referee to do? And my logic centers in my brain just exploded.
There's a little landstorm in all of us just saying, that doesn't make sense.
No.
It's like the Joker. We all become landstorm in the end. Like the Two-Face thing. Live long enough to die a hero, or live long enough to become Lance Storm.
So Triple X beat up Storm while taunting Harris with the handcuff key. So now tagging has stopped mattering as well.
I will inject some positivity at this stage, because I think it's sorely needed. You this can tell.
Must see matches podcast.
Well, we have said that it was a democratic process.
We had to watch Brett versus Sean 60-minute match. Oh, God. So they're not all bangers.
No.
Daniels very much came across as being the veteran we know he is, and I loved how he would constantly Chris Daniels with the handcuff key was great here, because it was constantly reminding you he had it. He was constantly taunting. He was constantly cheating. I just really liked that, because it's also a good way of reminding the fans, this is the thing that is needed. Now, the payoff eventually doesn't quite work, but I did like this segment of it.
I did say this contains some of my least favorite and most favorite things in wrestling. And one of my most favorite things in wrestling for a long time has been Christopher Daniels. I think he's consistently excellent and has been for 20 years now. Like, he's one of those people you can put him in with anybody and get a good one-off match. You can trust him with a story. You can trust him to be the veteran. He's a better heel than he is a babyface. But I think as he's got older, he's become better at being a babyface. I, for the most part, have nothing but praise for Christopher Daniels, particularly in this match. I thought he was excellent here.
Yeah, I love Elix Skipper. God bless him. But there's a reason Elix Skipper had some fantastic tag team matches, and never had remotely the same level of singles matches. And that reason is Christopher Daniels. Like, he's the veteran carrying this team. He's the veteran filling in the gaps in Elix Skipper's game and knowing exactly like what Skipper can do and what he can't, and playing Triple X to Elix Skipper's strengths. And fair play to him for doing that as well. It's an unselfish thing he's doing to highlight his tag team partner by covering over his shortcomings, which is how a tag team should work.
Yes, exactly. So the heels cut Storm open with the key, which I quite liked. I'm sure it will shock you to learn I've lost track of who is legal in this match, where it's apparently very, very important that we have legal men at all times.
Well, so did Rudy. I think it was Rudy. And that's the problem.
Yes.
He does care about who's legal. He's just forgotten. So it's a cage match. Everything goes then.
I was once on the booking team of a promotion, and we booked a tag team street fight for a main event between these four people who were feuding. And they came to us and went, it can be a street fight, but can we have tags? Because we can't figure out how to do a tornado street fight between us. And these are experienced wrestlers I'm talking about. They couldn't figure out how to just have four men have a fight in a ring.
What?
Yeah. They insisted on there being tags. Drove me up the wall. Anyway. We get into some like deep-seated issues I have with professional wrestling today. Eventually, Storm avoids a Daniels top rope move by making him collide with Skipper and then clatters in with a spear. The handcuff key comes loose and the ref stares at it. One stringy-haired bleeding man in black trunks crawls over to the key and hands it off to the other stringy-haired bleeding man in black trunks. And now we have two unencumbered baby faces, and tags really don't matter as they go to work on Triple X. No big pop for this getting released. I think because it took a while. Other than that one lady who's been going crazy all match, she was well on Chris Harris's side, wanting him to get out of this.
Yeah, no, I definitely think it's a case of, if that was a normal tag, like a hot tag out in a normal match, that would have got a great pop. If the handcuff had mysteriously popped immediately, fine. Yeah. The fact that you've got the pause before Storm hands off the key, and then it takes Harris about 20 seconds to uncuff himself, I just think it's a great idea in theory. In execution, it doesn't quite work.
Yeah, maybe gimmicked handcuffs with Harris's best friend is getting beaten up in front of him, and he becomes so enraged he is able to break free and snap the handcuffs. You know, that works as might work a bit better, but you're right, it took a long time for him to get out. And his first big move is some sort of reverse suplex on Elix Skipper, face first into the cage, and then pretty much drops him on his head. Harris does similar with Daniels in a regular suplex, but puts him down much safer. Triple X's suplex and crossbody combo is nice. That's an old Rockers move, I think. And then AMW come back with a heart attack because we're trading WWF tag team moves. Commentary make the very fair point that if it weren't for the Wildcat and Cowboy on their trunks, you wouldn't be able to tell AMW apart at this point. As I
Harris,
said,
Harris is pretty, like, he's much taller.
But like they spend a lot of time like face down on the ground getting kicked in, and it's just a lot of long hair and blood.
And also you consider that for most of the match, the angles that we're actually getting clear shots of is from above. Now this is, I'm not sure if this is a point to bring into it, but the first TNA match that we watched, Garrett, for this podcast was AJ versus Abyss from lockdown. And for me, the main difference between that match and this match is something that they obviously learned from here, is that they struggled to get good close-ups on any wrestler's face, and you struggled to get good clear close-ups because the cage was in the way. So by the time of lockdown, they had the bright idea of having that cutaway box where you could have a camera that fit in so that the cage was out of the way. And I actually went back and watched the lockdown match to try and work out, because I saw this and it's like, there's something about this that's bugging me and I don't remember it from lockdown. So I went back to lockdown, although back is actually in the future.
Yes, back to the future.
I went back to the future to watch lockdown to, and it's just having that clear viewpoint from being able to have a section of the cage cutaway to have the camera fit in to get those close-ups. I think it would have added more to this match, and the element of struggling to remember which one's Harris, which one's Storm, I wouldn't have had as much.
Hmm. Yeah,
you know what annoys me about that cutaway box?
What?
Which was like a TNA invention. It's a great idea. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, we have a cage match. We want to see inside the cage. Cut a little hole, shoot through the cage. Mm-hmm. No one else does it. It really annoys me that nobody else does it. It's like, that's a great idea that everybody should have done after this. And you mm-hmm. still see WWE doing cage matches and AEW doing cage matches without their little camera box. And it annoys me. Because as you said, yes. it's a very elegant, simple solution to what is a real problem of shooting through like mesh. You can't shoot yes. through mesh very well. So they're like, well, what if we cut a little hole in the mesh so we can shoot through the mesh? And no one else does it. Makes me mad.
So Triple X hit the death sentence on Harris, who has to kick out of his own team's finisher. Daniels tells Skipper to go to the top of the cage and they'll try it again. But Harris escapes, gives him a proper Mike Awesome top rope powerbomb. And now
this
is where I noted that the crowd had finally properly come alive.
I mean, if you don't come alive for that powerbomb, then pretty much you're not alive.
No. Skipper kicks out of it, though, and then Harris kicks out of the Angel's wings. Harris and Daniels climb to the top and they brawl precariously. Skipper also climbs up, one corner away from where Harris is now sat on the top, kicking down at Daniels. And then it happens. Under the guise of speculation, Tanay gives away what Skipper's going to do just before he does it.
Well, what else is he going to do, to be fair?
Yeah.
A diving lariat?
Yeah. But then it really happens. And you, if you're listening to this, you will have seen the GIF. Skipper tightrope walks the top of the cage, which is really just like a 2-inch thick pipe, and just about hits Harris with a Hurricane Rana. I've ragged on this match a bit so far. This is an incredible spot.
Because you get the moment where he's trying to find his footing on the cage.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
And you can see, if you've never seen a TNA cage and somehow never seen this spot, it's 2 inches wide, if that. And there's not like the WWE cage where there's these large corner sections you can get your footing on. It's just that very slender bit where that he has to climb, find his footing on, and then walk what is probably like a 6-foot stretch in midair and Hurricane Rana a man off the top of a cage. And you can see he takes like a couple of little tentative steps and then takes a lot of very fast steps as he realizes it's like, oh, I gotta finish this off. And the forgotten hero in this, to be fair, is Chris Harris, who has to take a flip bump off a steel cage. Yes. And he's just, he gets no credit for that. But like, it's one of the most visually impressive pro wrestling high spots you will ever see in your life.
And they shoot it pretty much perfectly.
Yeah, we were mentioning the crane cam. Without the crane cam, you do not get that perfect shot, like over Skipper's shoulder, basically, as he walks that steel cage and hits that Hurricane Rana. You could not have gotten a better shot of that move. It was absolutely perfect. And also, Daniels drops an elbow off a cage like 3 seconds later. No one remembers that either.
Yeah.
There are
and it's a damn good elbow off the cage.
There are three things I think people forget about this spot. This poor bastard took a top rope powerbomb not 90 seconds ago. He comes perilously close to falling off a minimum of 3 times, and it's a good 15 feet to the floor, and Harris is over the steps. So he could have hit the floor, the guardrail, the crowd, or the steps if he got off the wrong side. And number three, it's not the finish. It is, however, the move of Elix Skipper's life. I know you said you like him a lot, but I think even you admit, Garrett, he's not the world's greatest wrestler.
No.
He's not ultra charismatic.
Even when you watch him, because this is a version of a move he does regularly, which is the new school.
Yes.
The rope walker and Rana, he does as a regular move. He just did it 15 feet in the air in a cage. But like, at least like 20% of the time when he did the regular rope walk version, he'd slip.
Yes.
So for him to go up there in a pay-per-view main event, it must be known, main eventing over the final match of Randy Savage's career.
Yes. Yeah.
To go out there and do this on live pay-per-view with like the tiniest margin for error. Like you saw Jungle Boy with like a pretty large margin for error, basically miss an elbow drop off a cage a couple of weeks ago.
There's a shot in the replay of that Jungle Boy elbow drop where you can see how fast he falls. It's terrifying. It doesn't get any hang time. He just drops at terminal velocity into Luchasaurus, a table and a mat. The other thing about Elix Skipper is he is responsible for introducing one of the worst finishers of all time into professional wrestling.
Did he invent the overdrive?
He surely popularized. Play of the day was...
Yeah, his play of the day, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he first brought it in. I mean, he was using that in his WCW days. I'm a proud person that kind of enjoyed WCW Team Canada, even when they had Duggan turn heel on America.
And again, famous Canadian Elix Skipper.
Yes, exactly. All of those things aside, though, he will never be forgotten for this one crazy move.
And personally, I'll make personal sure of that this man will, it is my personal mission on planet Earth to ensure that moment is remembered, because it goddamn deserves to be.
Yeah. The commentators and crowd rightly lose their fucking minds. And as you said, point number four, Christopher Daniels follows it up with an elbow drop off the top of the cage over a prone Elix Skipper, which is also not the finish. I did like Tanay screaming and begging for production not to cut to a replay of the most spectacular move we've ever seen, because Chris Daniels is also about to do something stupid off the top of a cage.
Yeah, literally screaming to keep it live, because he's the director, apparently. Never mind Keith Mitchell in the truck. Mike Tanay's the director of this show.
So they then go to the stacked up stupid plex in the corner with Chris Daniels on the top. And he pretty much lands on his feet and gives Storm a rude awakening neckbreaker as he hits the mat, because he's over-rotated so much. And he is screaming and holding his back. And between this and that elbow drop, I don't know how he didn't come out of this 2 inches shorter than he went in.
TNA was the place where the Tower of Doom spot was popularized, if not innovated, wasn't it?
Yeah, there wasn't like a ton of them like at this stage. It was like 05, 06 X Division. All the guys I mentioned earlier on that Best of the X Division Volume 2 DVD. And anytime they'd do like a Lethal Lockdown, they'd have like the stacked up Tower of Doom spot. Mm. So yeah, TNA loved it.
It did become a TNA trope quite quickly, I do recall. So quite rightfully, Daniels and Storm get to lay down for a bit while Primetime and Wildcat batter each other. After they wipe each other out with what I called a silly spot, but I didn't write it down. Oh, yes, they simultaneously run each other halfway across the ring into the cage, which doesn't make any sense.
Nah, that rocks. That's like the right kind of dumb, idiotic pro wrestling, that the two guys are fighting so hard that they ram each other's heads into the steel cage simultaneously.
Also, we've not mentioned it enough, but there was so much ramming people into cages, which I'm here for. I just love a good throw someone face first into a cage.
The only person not bleeding all over the place from being thrown into the cage in this match is Elix Skipper. He managed to escape somehow.
I wonder, because Skipper, I don't think he bled in their first cage match either. But I also wonder, is he like, I'm going to walk that cage. I cannot have blood loss while walking cage.
Yeah, I cannot feel faint or have anything in my eyes.
It's like tripping over the blood dripping off his forehead and then slips off the cage. That's how that ends if he's bleeding.
That's the Homer Simpson version. So Daniels chucks Storm off the top rope. Then Harris does a running something to Daniels and he falls off the top rope.
It's meant Harris to be a step-up spear off the back of Harris, or off the back of Skipper. It? But he kind of just slips off Skipper and just
He just sort of runs face first into Chris Daniels' balls and he falls off.
Yeah, because he had to step off of Skipper into a spear to Daniels, but it was fine.
I half wonder, I know it's poetic justice what happens next, but they're at the door, and I do wonder if it was supposed to take them out through the door, if it was meant to be a spear then.
I'd imagine the door would, they still would have swung the door open, right?
Yeah.
Because the cage would have still been locked, unless they gimmicked the lock, of course. They showed us JB tying that lock, so I trust JB's lock tying skills.
What does happen is Harris handcuffs Daniels to the corner where he had been handcuffed, leaving Skipper all alone. James Storm wants to do the death sentence, but Harris says, no, they gave me our move. We're going to finish him off with their move. And they do.
I thought it was Harris saying, fuck off, am I getting back on top of that cage?
I did that death sentence off the cage once, never again.
Yeah, I haven't been able to walk for the past 18 months. One powerbomb neckbreaker combo thingy later that for some reason is called the Powerplex. Triple X and no more in 21 minutes and 1 second.
It's called the Powerplex because it's a powerbomb suplex. But which is the beer money finish, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. I knew I'd seen it elsewhere.
Perhaps, the drinking while investing, which is the beer money name of the first one.
Tremendous.
Which spells DWI, of course.
Of course. So, personally, there are things I like about this match. I can't fault the physical effort at all. You couldn't ask anyone in this match to give any more than they gave. I like that big spot. And like I said, it's immortalized Elix Skipper. And I thought Christopher Daniels worked his backside off, like being the glue, as well as making sure he got to do some crazy stuff himself so he wouldn't be overshadowed by everybody else. I despised the internal logic of this match. Like, either you enforce tags or it's no DQ. You can't have both. And saying that, any booker who books a DQ in a cage match can fuck right off and should have their pencil taken away.
Would you like to watch some 2009 TNA?
I might make some people angry. I think this is a 3.5-star match with a 5-star spot. It's a must-see move that happens in a match you don't necessarily have to watch the rest of. Discuss.
You're a monster?
I am, yeah.
I think, like, when you were thinking about, like, feud-ending matches, I think this is the bar where these guys go out there, they kill each other, they do insane stuff, they bleed absolute buckets. It's the classic, like, the mat is a different color after this match.
Yeah.
They bleed so much. It's like the perfect ending to a TNA rivalry, the defining tag team rivalry of the first 2 years of TNA. And just like thematically, it's four TNA guys. Fair enough, Harris was on WCW Worldwide. Daniels had some random WCW appearance as well. But they were never WCW guys. These are, and Skipper, you know, no one remembers Skipper as a member of TNA. Like, these are four what you would call homegrown guys main eventing their second monthly pay-per-view, as I said, over Randy Savage's final match. Match is a generous word for that walkout. And
I mean, I definitely just do one punch and that's his entire contribution to a match with five other people.
He does a sleeper hold and a punch, I'll have you know.
I'm sorry.
So that's the last match of Randy Savage's career. But main eventing over Savage, this is my favorite match in TNA history. So you with your monstrous 3.5 stars. But like everything from when they do get past that handcuff spot where they go like the powerbomb, they go to the cage walk, elbow drop, and then the Tower of Doom, and then into the finish. Like that last like 5 minutes where the crowd legitimately start chanting unprompted, best match ever.
Yes, that is true. They do that.
And I have to give a shout out to Mike Tenay and Don West, who are just sensational. And it boggles my mind that people hated Don West. Because I'm so glad that the history is on the other side now, that people are like, oh, his enthusiasm was awesome. Because if you look at like the Observer Awards during those eras, he was always nominated for Worst Announcer. Always. And it's such a travesty.
I do think early on, so like in the first year, he wasn't good. Like, he didn't know the product. He was just kind of reacting to stuff that happened in front of him. But once he got into it and like he really began to love the company, I think. Love wrestling, and yeah, like he became everything you wanted in a hype man and a color man later on, particularly paired with Tenay. Like, they're in such a good combination.
Yes,
and they perfectly fill in each other. Like, Mike Tenay is the knowledge guy, he's the guy to tell the story, and Don West is the hype and passion guy. Which,
yeah,
so the biggest argument you can make against Tenay, which I don't think is true of his TNA days, but it's probably true of his WCW days, is that while he knows everything, he doesn't like convey the emotion of the wrestling, which I think by the time during this match in TNA, he's nailed that as well. But like those two and the way they complement each other's skill sets, and they're not just bickering, they're not just, you know, trying to satisfy the man in their headset. They're both serving different roles and serving them very well and complementing each other very well. They're a perfect announced team. That word is in the announcers for a reason. They're an announced team. They're serving different purposes. I'm so glad they're getting their due these days, because they got a really unfairly hard time during this era of TNA. And I will truly never understand. It's a kind of like the same thing with the Michael Cole and Taz team, which I don't think was particularly loved at the time. But everyone goes back and is like, actually, no, those two were pretty great together, weren't they?
Yes. Mark, what have you got on this match?
I think the question coming into it was, is this match more than just that that fantastic cage walk rana, because that's the thing that people remember for this. And there's definitely a lot that I really like in this. Like, they had those big memorable spots. I had the big power moment. Did have this sense of the stakes mattered. As Garrett said in the second half, the crowd was so hot. It worked really well. There was some bits that didn't work in the finish, like the spear kind of fell apart a bit. But there's definitely, I like violent, passionate matches. I think I've summed it up. My favorite thing in wrestling is just watching people show fire and show passion and show energy. And you definitely get that here. There's some execution issues. Yes, there's some small flaws, like the way it's shot. I think if TNA had learned the tricks that they learned by the time they got to lockdown, I think I would have liked this a little bit more, because I think they could have filmed it slightly different. Because I definitely think if you watch this and then you watch lockdown back to back, you can tell that TNA have learned things from this match in how to film a cage match. And as you say, there's some logical plot holes. It's like, I'm not going to say that this is one of the best matches that we've watched, but I also don't think it's one of the worst. I really like bits of it. It's what I want out of this kind of match. And it's kind of what I have a lot of fond nostalgia for this period of TNA. I say this as a man with a lot of fond nostalgia for things like Chronic and Jindrak and O'Hare from WCW. It's like, I am someone who will not judge you, because I like some stuff that I admit is pretty damn ropey. I'm not calling this ropey, but I did. It's not as crisp as you think it is in hindsight, but it definitely achieves everything you can. And I was looking at...
A grudge match doesn't have to be crisp. Like, you're people who want to kill each other. Like, it should be messy.
And it scratches that itch. The thing that I want to say, it's maybe stealing what you do, Kieran, is... So Dave gave this a 4.75.
Yeah.
And it's a 9.43 on cage match. Also, because yes, I put this effort in, this show was the highest TNA match in cage match up to this point. Like, a 7.6 is the highest any TNA show actually got in cage match before you get to, say, Sacrifice and Unbreakable the next year. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, so you can argue that this is a crucial match, a crucial point for TNA, because 2005's, I remember 2005 being the time when in-ring everything, not everything, because Jarrett was still bloody champion, but almost everything clicked.
Yeah, yeah. It was where it became WCW, where you had the title matches on the top that had the stars, and then people working very hard underneath, I think. Mm. The other thing that the Observer said about this match was that it blew away the match the two teams had 17 months ago, and that may have been the best match in TNA history. There is little question in my mind that this now has those honors.
Because TNA wasn't a work rate company, like far from it. Because if you were to ask me to nominate two matches from like the first 2 years of TNA, from the pre-pay-per-view, monthly pay-per-view era, I nominate the first Triple X AMW cage match, and I probably nominate the first X Division title match from the very second show. It's like, if you go to our star rating spreadsheet that we're doing for our own podcast from 2004, which we have nearly the entire year done, I'm pretty sure I have like 3-4 star matches for the entire year. Like, this is not a good in-ring period for TNA. But I think this match is what kind of kickstarted TNA's reputation for must-see pay-per-views. Because the next month they would come back with an absolutely fantastic AMW against Team Canada match. Like, full-on old-school Southern wrestling. Like, the Team Canada filling the old-school heels, and AMW just that their entire act was like the old-school Southern babyfaces doing it better than FTR ever did, without any of the pretense. I always have to throw that dig at FTR in. But like, this is what kicked off that reputation. And the next one, we also have the Style Save and PD Ultimate X match, which also rocks. And a word for America's Most Wanted, who we didn't really focus on here. We talked a lot about Triple X and Daniels in particular.
Yeah.
But AMW as that babyface tag team, you pair them with any heel combination. You pair them with the New Church. You pair them with Diamond and Swinger. They had great matches with Diamond and Swinger. Beyond comprehension, because it's Diamond and Swinger, who are, you know, decent wrestlers, but never guys you'd be like, go out of your way to see a Simon Diamond match. They had great matches with the Naturals. They had the best. They basically had the best match with any team they worked with. Then they turned heel and they'd have great matches with Styles and Daniels as well, and a couple of decent matches with Team 3D, I guess. Not that Dudley's best work in TNA. But like those two, James Storm and Chris Harris, tag team wrestling was dead in North America in the first half of that decade. Other than America's Most Wanted. They were like the shiny beacon on the hill of a decrepit corpse. Because you had like the SmackDown 6 era in 2002, where you got some decent tag team stuff there from WWE, but basically nothing else after that. You'd get like the random good World's Greatest Tag Team match. But it wasn't the focus in WWE, and AMW were the team, and they were so good. And I'm kind of sad they've been, I think, a little bit forgotten, especially even relative to Beer Money. Like, James Storm's more visible tag team, I guess, when TNA had more viewers. More people remember Beer Money than they do AMW, which is the reason, like, when AMW had that little reunion this year, you know, it was just a 10-man tag. It was them, the Good Brothers, and Heath against Honor No More. And they just got to play the hits for the first time in, like, 15 years. And I nearly cried when they hit the death sentence in that match, because I'm a giant weeping baby. But just hearing the AMW music in 2022 and seeing them hit a death sentence one more time brought a tear to my eye. And like, this match, as I said, I think it defined TNA's reputation at that stage as a company that is worth watching bell to bell. And they would carry that reputation for most of 05 and a lot of 06 until Russo came back and ruined it all again. But that's a different podcast.
Yes. Speaking of a different
podcast.
That's
your podcast.
Exactly that. Thank you so much for joining us today. The floor is yours to plug your wares.
See, that's me being a podcasting professional, adding the segue there. I'm not even hosting it. I'm throwing in segues. If you would like to hear a lot more about TNA, a lot more about this match, the backstage stuff around this match and this show in particular, the current episode of our podcast, You've Got to Be Kidding Me, a TNA history podcast, is actually covering Turning Point 2004. It's covering all the matches on that show, including the Randy Savage match, including Petey Williams against AJ Styles, including Raven against DDP in DDP's TNA debut. So if you search You've Got to Be Kidding Me in your podcast platform of choice, you can find that show, and we've covered every month of TNA up until December of 2004, and we will continue covering it until we lose our minds, which, who knows, will that be sooner or later? And you can follow me on Twitter for as long as that exists, at Gary Kidney.
Tremendous. You can find us on Twitter and now Instagram, as long as I keep that up, at Mussie Matches. The best place to go for all of our links and social whatnot is linktr.ee/Mussie Matches. I am at Kieran Edits, and Mark is
at Monkey_Buckles.
I also need to plug my regular appearances on GCP, as Andy Ogden and I review UWA Wrestling Rampage, a British wrestling TV show from 1999, which is a load of fun to talk about. Head to at GCP Podcast 1 for all of that. Next week, Sarah Parkin returns as we talk our first Japanese women's tag team match. Akira Hokuto and Shinobu Kandori versus Aja Kong and Bull Nakano from Wrestling Queendom on March the 27th, 1994. So make sure you're here for that. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.